This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. Today we're talking about the abuse and exploitation of seniors and endangered adults in Indiana and a nonprofit working to help people who need it. We'll talk about some of the most common kinds of exploitation that happen, why so much of it goes unreported, and what elements of our state's court system seem to make certain crimes around guardianship more difficult to catch. With us now, we have two guests, Jessica Brock, staff attorney and project director of the LAVA Project at Indiana Legal Services, and Courtney Sweat, attorney at Indiana Legal Services. Welcome to both of you. Thank you so much for joining us this afternoon. Jessica, there's been a lot of talk lately when it comes to conservatorship surrounding the Britney Spears case. We're not going to go into details on that specific case, but have these conversations sparked renewed interest in the topic of conservatorship and some of the legal cases you work on?
Definitely. The Britney Spears case has people talking about conservatorship. And just to be clear, a conservatorship is the same thing as a guardianship. And here in Indiana, we use the term guardianship. So people are talking a lot more about guardianship. I think that the news is helping people to ask questions about what a guardianship means, what restrictions it places on a person who is under guardianship, what rights that person still has, how they voice those rights in a court, when guardianships are necessary or not. And that is a large part of the work we do is ensuring that guardianships are free of exploitation and that they are necessary. So it's definitely started a conversation about a topic that we deal with a lot.
Mm-hmm. And Courtney, what are your thoughts on this Britney Spears story? Is that giving more people insight into how these systems work?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that just like Jessica said, our job is to make sure that those guardianships are free of exploitation. And I think that this Britney Spears case has kind of highlighted that these guardianships, while there may be a broad conception that if someone is trying to seek guardianship over an individual, they usually have good intentions. But these cases that are coming to light now, in the Britney Spears case, are going to show that just because someone is saying that they are trying to help an individual doesn't necessarily mean that they actually are going to do that. And I think that there have been a lot of questions brought up and understanding of what conservatorships and guardianships are, and also bringing a voice, I think, to a lot of people that don't have as much of a voice, and answering the questions that people have about those kinds of cases. And I think that's really important to get that kind of knowledge out there to prevent this kind of abuse from happening, and also to make people aware, because the more people are aware that this kind of abuse does occur, the more they can be on the lookout for if that kind of abuse is occurring to someone around them.
Mm-hmm. And when it comes to this particular story, are there any misconceptions that are coming out about what a conservatorship is? Do you feel like news reports are getting it right, or is there something that's not accurate?
Well, I have to admit, I haven't watched every news story on the Britney Spears case, but I can say in our experience that there is a general misconception or misunderstanding about the difference between a power of attorney and a guardianship. Oftentimes, people assume that they're synonymous, and they are not. So the easiest way for me to sort of explain the difference is a power of attorney is an instrument for those who are living, who have the ability to make decisions for themselves. It's just a contract, and you're giving someone else or other people the authority to act on your behalf. A guardianship is also for the living, but it's for people who no longer can manage their own affairs, whether that's because of a cognitive decline, maybe they've had a traumatic brain injury, some other limitation. And so a court has to determine that the person is, the legal word is incapacitated, that they are unable to make their own decisions or manage their own affairs. And then a guardian is appointed for them. And that person really ceases to be as a legal person in the world, which is very different from someone with a power of attorney. So helping people to understand the difference between the two and how they're initiated, and the differences in oversight. A guardianship is overseen by a court. That's the safeguard in place in a guardianship, whereas a power of attorney, that contract is not automatically overseen by a court. So that major difference in just its role in society is often misunderstood.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I appreciate learning the details, because I even didn't really realize there was this much difference. And I'm wondering about with the guardianship. So is it the court that determines if the person is incapable of handling their own affairs, or do they bring in experts? How does that work?
The court should bring in experts. You know, judges oftentimes should be an attorney. And so our expertise is legal, not medical or psychological.
Mm-hmm.
So most local court rules require the filing of what's called a physician statement when someone asks or petitions the court to start a guardianship. And that physician statement should be thorough and explain what diagnoses or life events cause a person to have limited capabilities. And it should be very specific, based on some good knowledge of the patient, about which things they can continue to do for themselves or make decisions about, and which things they can't. Currently, our system, the default is that people ask for what we call a full guardianship, meaning every right of the person or every decision of the person is handed over to the guardian, when many times that's not appropriate. The guardianship should be done in a way that's least restrictive,
mm-hmm.
To the protected person. So maybe they only need help with complex financial decisions, but they can certainly, you know, pay their bills and do their own grocery shopping. That's a huge distinction. And so that evidence about the kinds of decisions a person can make or the activities of daily living they can handle should be in that physician statement. Oftentimes, neuropsychological evaluations are done, and that information is presented to the court to help suss out what's necessary and what's not.
Mm-hmm. Well, Courtney, this stuff sounds a little bit intimidating. If somebody had to be put under a guardianship, if all of these things are decided for them, even if they don't need it, is there anything being done to address that?
So I think the biggest thing being done at this point is our project, probably.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, we are one of the few groups in the state that handle these kinds of cases. And unfortunately, years prior to us forming this project, a lot of these cases have gone uncontested, which essentially just means that, you know, the guardian has an attorney to petition for the guardianship. However, the protected person who's going to be restricted by this guardianship, it's rare that the courts see that they are represented by an attorney, even though they have the right to do so. So a lot of the difficulties come from opposing counsel thinking that the client doesn't have a right to have an attorney within the case. And we've had to fight some uphill battles to even be able to be present within a guardianship case to help represent that person's rights. And those changes have also come into play in some statutory changes, which in 2019, the legislature did put into the statute that the court is required to review the lesser restrictive alternatives that were attempted in guardianships, meaning, kind of like Jessica said, if an individual is capable of doing their own grocery shopping and is capable for small financial decisions, but they need help with larger decisions, then the court would want to see what other options you put into place in order to prevent taking away those rights from that individual. And mm-hmm. that could be variations of things, whether that's automatic bill pay online to ensure that their bills are being paid without having that right to be able to do that on their own taken away from them. Or if there is a power of attorney that has been tried before. Maybe that has been unsuccessful. So the court thinks, well, if it's a power of attorney hasn't been successful, maybe we do need to move forward with a guardianship. But if those points haven't been tried yet, the court is going to ask, why haven't those been tried before we start taking away a person's rights? And I think that it's very important for the courts to really take stock and look at that as to whether those less restrictive alternatives have been explored in order to prevent someone from basically having their life taken away from them.
Right, right. Well, we have about a minute before we head to the break. Jessica, can you just tell us a little bit more about LAVA and what the work is that you do?
Sure. So the LAVA project is a part of Indiana Legal Services. We are a statewide project in all 92 counties of Indiana, and we provide civil legal representation to seniors, so folks 60 or older, and endangered adults who are victims of crime, regardless of their income. So it can be any kind of crime. It doesn't have to be reported to authorities or charged in a criminal case. We help stop the abuse, whether that's financial, domestic violence, sexual assault, emotional abuse, scammers, and then help people recover from that, whether that means recovering property or money. We have an advocate trained in social work to help people get back on track. So our work is to help end abuse and empower survivors to get their lives back.
All right. Well, we'll talk more about that after the break. We'll be back with our guests. We're talking about abuse and exploitation of seniors and endangered adults in Indiana and efforts to help those in need. If you have any questions or comments for the show, you can let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Sobe. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. We're talking today about cases of abuse and exploitation of seniors and endangered adults in Indiana. We love your questions and comments on the topic. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana, or you can leave us a voicemail, including your first name and where you're calling from at 866-476-3881. You can also send us a voice message through our free smartphone app. It's called All In Vox Pop. Just search for All In Vox Pop on your phone's app store. Send us your question or comment, and we'll try to get it onto the show. With us again are Jessica Brock, staff attorney and project director of the LAVA Project at Indiana Legal Services, and Courtney Sweat is an attorney at Indiana Legal Services. Before the break, we were talking a little bit about the LAVA Project, and I'm curious to know, why did you feel the need that you had to have a project targeted at this specific group of folks? Is there a lack of support right now in Indiana for people in these situations?
There's definitely a lack of support in Indiana and frankly across the nation. The LAVA Project is one of the first of its kind in the United States. Now there are more projects like ours, but when we started in January of 2017, there were few projects exactly like ours. But the need came. Dennis Frick, who's an attorney at Indiana Legal Services and directs our senior law project, has a lot of experience working with older adults and had seen cases of abuse in his legal career and had wanted to do something intentional to address elder abuse. And about that time, the Indiana Criminal Justice Institute that funds our project along with Equal Justice Works, said that we have this funding available. Do you have a project you would like to put together? And the front page of the Indianapolis Star had this huge article on how adult protective services in the state of Indiana needs more resources and support. So the idea, Dennis had this great idea to form a project that would address elder abuse, but also help support the clientele of adult protective services by making our project also available. Anyone, an endangered adult is the legal title given to someone who's eligible for adult protective services. So anyone who works with adult protective services is eligible to be one of our clients. So we're able to address elder abuse while also supporting the clientele of adult protective services, both very vulnerable and often overlooked populations in our state.
Mm-hmm. And you know, I would say from my understanding now, learning about all of this, it seems like it's overlooked because we don't often think of adults as being in need of help. We think of children, right? Is anything being done to change that aside from the project that you're doing? Any awareness campaigns or anything, Courtney?
Yeah, there are a ton of ongoing trainings that programs like the National Center on Elder and Law Rights does, and as well as Equal Justice Works is also pushing trainings and information about elder abuse. And I think that it's just a topic, like you said, that a lot of people don't think about an adult needing those kinds of services. And they typically think that an adult is perfectly capable and able to defend themselves and protect themselves in these kinds of situations. And I think it just speaks a lot to the fact that there's sometimes shame that is imposed on individuals where they feel ashamed that they've been taken advantage of, or the advantage is being taken by their adult child or family members. So they don't want to report them because there's a whole other family dynamic there of causing disturbances in the family peace. So it's difficult for a lot of those individuals to either have the ability or the courage to be able to reach out and ask for help. And I think by being one of those additional resources to Adult Protective Services, it offers Adult Protective Services an option to be able to provide their clientele, like, hey, here's a resource. I understand that you're feeling this way and you have concerns about reaching out, but even sometimes if they don't want to pursue criminal charges against their child, they may still be willing to pursue the civil cause. They may not want them to go to jail, but they still want some sort of justice. And I think that our project is a good bridge to that gap. And I think it is empowering a lot of citizens across our state to be able to stand up for themselves.
Mm-hmm. Now, if an individual is facing exploitation or abuse from either a family member or a guardianship or something like that, how would they report it? Is there somebody that's systematically checking in on them, or is this a case where they would have to find the resources on their own?
Well, everyone in the state of Indiana is a mandatory reporter of elder abuse or abuse. So if you witness or know of abuse of an adult, you are required by law to report that to Adult Protective Services or local law enforcement. And APS or local law enforcement will investigate the report. All reports are anonymous. So that's one tool. We have ombudsmen in our facilities in the state of Indiana advocating for the rights of folks who live there. They are another resource if someone is facing exploitation or abuse in a facility setting. We get a lot of referrals from area agencies on aging and councils on aging who often provide transportation to older adults. They might come in for meals and conversation. Maybe a romance scam comes up in conversation, or a bad roofing situation, or a relative who won't let them leave the house without permission or takes their mail. So mm-hmm. they get connected with us. We also get a number of reports from financial institutions, the fraud departments at banks. We've done trainings with them, and they help identify accounts that are overdrawn and bring those to the account holders' attention and help connect them to us. Law enforcement, some prosecutors have partnered with us. We're hoping to get in with medical providers, because that's one place where we believe those who are experiencing abuse would be in a safe and private setting to be able to say in confidence to, you know, the nurse or the doctor, hey, you know, I need some help while we're in this room, just the two of us. Can you find me some help? Whether that's alerting APS, calling law enforcement, calling us. So there are a number of ways people can connect. And we're currently, we're very excited about this. I wish it was ready today to say, go do it now. But we're working on developing an online, it's called the Legal Risk Detector. And it's basically like WebMD for legal problems. So people, when they have the link, will be able to go to that website, and it's a self-guided, you answer questions about housing issues and financial exploitation, access to housing, domestic violence, different topics. And at the end of completing it, the risk detector tells you whether or not you seem to be at risk, that you have, you know, some kind of legal issue. And from there, the person will be given a list of resources, but also has the option of generating a referral to us to apply for legal assistance. So we're hoping that that will be a useful tool to folks once we get it up and running later this year.
Well, so you guys have a lot of systems in place. It's really impressive to hear about all of this expansion. When it comes to the cases that you receive, Courtney, is there a sense for how many cases of abuse or exploitation are actually reported versus those that aren't?
There, I believe Jessica has more specific statistics, but I would say that there's a large majority are not reported. And I think that goes towards a lot to do with, you know, as I said, family conflict or just the shame that they've been taken advantage of, or the fact that they feel like they've already been through so much. Why would they want to drag themselves through the court system and put themselves through even more trauma? Jessica, can you recall the top of your head the statistics?
Sure. So the estimates are that 1 in 9 or 1 in 10 older adults suffer abuse, neglect, or exploitation. And that's a national estimate. Mm-hmm. And I would assume that the statistic is right around there in Indiana. And frankly, when I started working in this project, when I heard that statistic, I thought that really just, I thought maybe that was over exaggerated. But I tell you, talking to family and friends when they ask me what I do for a living, just in conversation, I've not had a single person who hasn't had a story either personally or a coworker or someone they know of a family member who has been the victim of a scam or taken advantage of by a relative. So I'm actually kind of thinking that that statistic may be understating the problem. And, you know, in addition to the harm that the abuse does itself, it's also a major health factor for older adults. Seniors who are abused, neglected, or exploited are at 3 times the risk of death. It has a major toll on their health going through these cases and going through the abuse. So it's not just a legal problem. It really is a public health problem as well. And then the other estimate is that only 1 in 24 of these cases are reported to authorities. And as Courtney said, a lot of that is to do with shame. So many clients tell us that they feel stupid or that they should have known better or how could they have trusted someone. And we're hoping by letting folks know that this is unfortunately a pervasive problem. You're not alone. These scammers, I mean, it's their business. They are in the business of scamming and they're really good at it. They're really good at making it look legitimate or they wouldn't be in business. And to let them know that there's a free resource. We are free. We are confidential. As Courtney said earlier, you know, no one's going to jail automatically if you call us. So if you just want to know if the situation you're in is a problem, what your options might be, and you want to leave it at that, we're happy to provide that advice so that the person can make a more informed decision. We just want people to know that there are safe resources available for anyone who finds themselves in such a terrible position.
Mm-hmm. And we mentioned earlier, we were talking a little bit about the shame and the stigma that maybe gives people pause to report or talk about this. Courtney, is there anything, I mean, aside from these awareness campaigns or letting people know that they're not alone, is there anything that would get people to be more comfortable? Or let's say our listeners are wondering how they can help someone if they suspect something like this is going on.
I think the biggest thing you can do is have a conversation with that individual away from whoever that person thinks is abusing them. That conversation is so important because while we are here to offer protection for individuals, we also don't want to take away their rights. So if they choose to not do anything about a situation, they are adults who have the right to make that decision. And if they don't want to proceed in any legal form, then they should not be forced to do so. So I think just having a conversation with them in a safe environment where it can be done privately without the knowledge of the abuser, I think is where you have to start. And then helping that individual in any way you can, if they do alert you that they would like to seek further assistance, whether that's helping them get to the police department to make a police report if they want to, or helping them get online and submit an application for services with ILS, or helping them get out of the house so that they can make a phone call to us to be able to submit an application. A lot of our clients do end up being confined to their home, and they don't necessarily have a way to get out and about to be able to go and seek help. Or because we work with elderly individuals, you know, it's common for those individuals to not have access to internet or have a cell phone to be able to use. So that way, the only way they can make a phone call is within the home in front of the abuser, if the abuser lives with them, or having to somehow find an internet connection to be able to search for resources. So just being a guide for them and being another resource for them to be able to access those resources that they may not be able to get to, whether it be just mobility issues or it's just the abuser prevents them from being able to get access to those things.
Mm-hmm. Well, Jessica, when it comes to the scammers, you mentioned a couple times about how scammers take advantage of older adults. Is help for folks who have been scammed, is it only for people of a certain age range, you know, like senior citizens, or can anybody get help?
In our project, the person would need to be an older adult, 60 or older, or fit into the endangered adult category. And if they fall into the endangered adult definition, the person can be 18 years or older. One of the sort of threshold, it's not the only requirement, but a sort of baseline requirement to fall into the endangered adult category is to have some sort of disability. But if you're unsure whether we can provide assistance, we definitely encourage you to apply. The worst we can say is you don't qualify or we're unable to help. There are other resources available at the state, and national levels. Folks are encouraged to make reports to the Indiana Attorney General and their Consumer Division if they fall prey to a scam or a bad business practice. You can make reports to the Better Business Bureau. Nationally, you can make reports to the Federal Trade Commission and the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, and they have great resources on identity theft and helping folks walk out of that situation. So there are some other state and federal resources, but they are more in giving information and helping to report rather than helping on an individual case-by-case basis. That's a different kind of resource.
Mm-hmm. Would you say that you handle more scammer-type cases than other things with the rise of the internet and all of these things that look so real, or is it pretty similar?
They seem to come in waves for reasons we'll never understand. Sometimes it's scam month, and sometimes it's guardianship month, and sometimes it's roofing month. We had a lot of scams, I would say, towards the beginning of our project. I've seen a decline in them. There's limited help that we can provide in a scam situation. Ordinarily, money out is money gone. Because most of the scammers are international, difficult to locate, and so therefore difficult to sue. We have been able to get some relief for folks who sent money in a scam via wire transfer. there's some money available, and we could talk about that more later if you'd like.
Yeah, definitely. Well, thank you so much. We're going to take a quick break. We're talking with legal experts about the abuse and exploitation of seniors and endangered adults in Indiana. If you have any questions or comments, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Sobe. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam. So back now to our discussion on the abuse and exploitation of seniors and endangered adults in Indiana and what's being done to keep people safe. If you have any questions or comments, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana, or you can leave us a short voicemail with your first name and where you're calling from at 866-476-3881. With us again are Jessica Brock, staff attorney and project director of the LAVA Project at Indiana Legal Services, and Courtney Sweat, an attorney at Indiana Legal Services. Before the break, we kind of touched upon the different seasons of types of things that happen, from scammers to guardianship issues. Courtney, I'm curious, you know, some of these scamming things, it makes me think of my own experience with visiting family, and every time there's like a hailstorm, someone will come to the door and be like, "We can fix your hail damage." And I'm always trying to tell my parents, "Do not answer the door." Are these kinds of scams that are common?
So I would say, you know, scams come in various shapes and sizes. And, you know, I don't think we necessarily see a lot of people who just come to the door and offer services and just take money and run away. We more so see individuals who seem to have what our clients think are a legitimate business. And sometimes they come out and they start work and then they just don't finish it. Or they come out and they purchase materials and they start working and then they just disappear. Or they tell the individual, "Well, I'm not going to come and finish the work until you pay me this much money." Yes, so I think that it's more so individuals who seem to have legitimate businesses who come and then end up not completing the work. So we just really push for our clients to research who you are hiring to do any housework for you, check with the Better Business Bureau, make sure that they don't have, you know, a laundry list of complaints that have already been filed against them, check reviews with your neighbors and friends and look online and make sure they're legitimate before ever agreeing to give them any kind of money or having them come into your home in any way. Those are the biggest ways that you can protect yourself from those kinds of scams.
Right, right. And Jessica, I mean, are these the types of cases that you get a lot from folks who need help, these kinds of issues dealing with paying for something and someone never coming back?
We do get a lot of consumer cases, which include the kind of scam you were just mentioning, Miriam. Oftentimes, folks will say they're licensed, bonded, and insured, but they've never laid a shingle in their life. And there are Indiana statutes like the Deceptive Consumer Sales Act and the Senior Consumer Protection Act, which are, especially the Senior Consumer Protection Act, designed specifically to punish people who take advantage of older adults in this kind of way. And there are major penalties and fines involved in that law if folks break it. We often have to explain to people there's a difference between doing a bad job and being fraudulent. So if someone comes and you just don't like the work they did, that's not fraud. But if they say they're going to do something and then they have no intention of doing it, you know, like they say, "I'm going to roof your house," but they never intend to roof it, that is an example of fraud. So we have to kind of discern whether someone just doesn't like the work that was done or whether there was actual fraud that took place. We mm-hmm. also get a lot of, you know, internet, Facebook, phone scams as part of our consumer work. People overcharging for insurance that's unnecessary, or we have a lot of cases that involve manufactured homes or titles to cars, where the purported seller didn't have the title or the deed to the piece of property that they're trying to sell our client. So they take the cash and run away. That's another big consumer area we deal with.
Wow. So it's just all over the place. And it's interesting because when we were first talking about this topic, I was imagining, you know, guardianship, abuse, different things, but I didn't realize the scams are also a huge part of what affects especially the elderly population.
Yeah, abuse comes in every flavor imaginable. We often say, you know, you just can't make this stuff up, and it's true. And unfortunately, you know, we have a problem with ageism. It's one of the isms in our culture where, you know, you mentioned rightly so, Miriam, earlier on that we don't think of adults really maybe as being vulnerable. And that's true. But at the same time, I think we often discount the agency of older adults. And so when they report to a family member or someone that this situation has happened, oftentimes they're laughed away or brushed off like, you know, that can't possibly have happened. That makes no sense. And oftentimes that's the result of that ageism. And that's a big obstacle in identifying and preventing the abuse. We really need to take the person's story seriously and see if there's any validity to it. There may or may not be, but they deserve to have the story investigated, because oftentimes these stories make no sense. You wouldn't believe it actually happened that way if you didn't see the paperwork yourself.
Mm-hmm. Well, when it comes to guardianships, Courtney, what kind of cases do you typically see when it comes to that?
Guardianships are typically either handled by a private person who the individual knows, whether that is a niece, nephew, sibling, child, grandchild, or if that individual does not have a person that's close to them in their lives that would be able to be willing to step in and become guardian for them. Sometimes there are professional guardianship services that different businesses across the state run, where for a small fee, they act as a professional guardian for the individual. And we do see abuse in guardianship cases from both sometimes those private companies that do the guardianships, as well as from family members who are acting as guardian or close friends. There is not a clear line, I think, where the abuse comes from more than the other. I think a lot of times when we have our professional guardianship cases, normally the client is more so concerned with either lack of communication, where the professional guardian isn't informing them of what's going on with their finances, or they aren't allowing them to live where they think they should be allowed to live. So a guardian has control over if an individual is allowed to continue living in their own home, or they can request that the court approve them to be removed from their home and placed in either a nursing facility or an assisted living facility. So a lot of times we see professional guardians moving our clients to those facilities, and then our clients thinking that they don't need to be there. It's a waste of money. They are capable of taking care of themselves at home. So this is an overly restrictive alternative, and they should have the right to choose to be in their home. And I think we notice a lot more financial exploitation and abuse coming more from family members. And I think that probably has to do with there's less oversight. When you have a professional guardian, you have a caseworker who's working your case. And then those caseworkers, they have supervisors. And you would hope that financial abuse wouldn't come from those individuals, since you have multiple hands in the pot kind of keeping an eye on everybody. That doesn't mean it doesn't happen. I think it's not as easy to get away with it in those settings, I think, versus when you have private guardianships where there is no oversight except for the court. That makes it a lot easier for the perpetrator to exploit the protected person. And if the court isn't keeping up on proper accountings that are supposed to be filed biannually according to the statutes, then those exploitations could slip through the cracks. So we see a mix of the cases. we've handled both cases from those professional guardianship services as well as cases from private individuals as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, when it comes to sort of folks being exploited in guardianship cases, how do they generally realize this is happening? Is it somebody on the outside that notices? Are they noticing their money is missing? You know, what does that scenario look like?
So I think it's a good combination. A lot of our clients do have other family members, other friends who aren't the guardian and who start to notice these signs, whether, they notice they go to the grocery store, the protected person, and then all of a sudden their bank account is overdrafted. And the protected person doesn't understand why their bank account's overdrafted when they just got their Social Security check. There's no reason this should be overdrafted. So they start seeing these signs. And I think also they start recognizing control issues. So I've had clients who they are in assisted living facilities and they've been prevented from making phone calls to their relatives. And so sometimes we will have relatives reach out to try to get us to help get access to their friends or family members and advise us that they think that something's not right here. And I think that looking for those signs and also bringing it to the attention of the protected person, if you are able to get in contact with them and saying, you know, hey, this something's not seeming right to me. I don't know if they're acting in your best interests. I don't know if they're using your money and paying your bills the way they're supposed to, or if they're taking the money and using it for things for themselves, or just letting the money go to waste.
Yeah, well, I'm curious to know about, you know, how do Indiana's laws around guardianships combat some of this? Jessica, have there been any changes made in recent years to ensure that folks who have family members doing their guardianship are checked up on?
So there are safeguards built into the guardianship statute, and there was a major update to the guardianship statute in 2019. So one safeguard to the guardianship statute is at the very beginning of the case, when someone says so-and-so needs a guardian, that proof that they should be required to show the court about why the guardianship is necessary, why less restrictive alternatives won't meet the person's needs, and the person's right to a hearing, to be at that hearing. You wouldn't believe the number of times there's no hearing or the person isn't there at the beginning. So that's one safeguard that needs to happen. Another one is the guardianship statute requires that the guardian file with the court and give a copy to the protected person, which people may be more familiar with the term ward, the term in Indiana's protected person, every 2 years, an accounting of all of the financial transactions done on that person's behalf, bank statements, any property transferred, an inventory of their property, as well as of their health, where they're living, are they working, are they studying, who are their relatives. All of that has to be presented and reviewed and approved by the court, and the protected person should have the opportunity to review that and have, you know, any objections to that accounting heard by the court every 2 years. Unfortunately, many courts do not have some kind of automatic calendaring system to remind it that if they haven't gotten accounting, they should. Some courts do, and it's wonderful. We've been in cases where it's been 12 years since something was filed in the case, so that two-year check-in is obviously not doing its job. And then the third checkpoint is the change that happened to the Indiana law in 2019 that requires proof that what we call least restrictive alternatives are not viable options, that guardianship is necessary. So power of attorney won't work, a supported decision-making agreement won't work, using a representative payee or auto bill pay won't work. All of those things should be explained in full to the court at the beginning of the case and again every 2 years when that accounting is presented. So if all of those things are followed as they should be, there are some supports in the law. Other states like Nevada have totally overhauled their guardianship statutes. And now, for example, in Nevada, every person who is under guardianship or might become under guardianship is appointed an attorney by the court that the court pays for. So they are represented throughout the entire case. So you have another set of eyes, you know, asking for the accounting, looking at the bills, paying attention to where they're moved or not moved. Indiana hasn't done that, but other states have taken, you know, more steps to try to protect folks under guardianship.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're getting ready to wrap up here. I just want to ask real quick, each of you, where does Indiana stand compared to other states? Are we on the right path?
I think we are doing a lot of good things. The, you know, the amendment to the guardianship statute was welcome news and can be very helpful if it's used. We certainly think that the LAVA project is a big help. Being one of the first programs of our kind in the country, Indiana is doing great and helping other states form their programs in our with our experience. So, and we have a statewide group in case, a coalition of folks who are all working with older adults and interested in combating elder abuse, meeting and talking to one another. So things are happening. Of course, there's always more you can do, but I think we're taking good first steps.
Mm-hmm. And Courtney, what do you think about the way things are now? Is it getting better, or is there still a lot more to do?
I think that realistically, we can only go up from here. The more awareness we bring, the more we're talking about this and lowering the stigma of the shame that comes along with reporting these kinds of issues is definitely going to keep us moving into the future in the right direction of where we need to go. The LAVA project alone, since our inception in 2017, has helped over 650 clients, and we've provided over 2,000 services across the state of Indiana. And that's 650 people who may not have been able to be helped before us. And so as our project continues to grow and awareness continues to spread, I think more individuals will have the opportunity to receive help.
All right. Well, thank you both so much for joining us today and offering all that insight. Jessica Brock is a staff attorney and project director of the LAVA Project at Indiana Legal Services. And Courtney Sweat is an attorney at Indiana Legal Services. Our producers are Drew Doblin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at All in Indiana. I'm Miriam Sobe. Thanks for listening. This is All In.